Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse, here with my two OIG partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired Assistant Special Agent Charge from the LA Field Office and Manager on one of our SIU investigative teams, and of course, Matt Kachansky, the retired Special Agent Charge from the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC Director, and now the Senior Director of our overall payment integrity options. There's a lot of options in payment integrity.
A lot of options.
So I think it's good to start calling it the Payment Integrity Options Team. P-I-O. P-I-O. It's going to be a new name. We're getting away from SIU. We're going to call it P-I-O.
P-I-O-T.
P-I-O-T.
Oh, yeah. Team.
Piat.
Piat. Sounds very European. Sounds very international. Very, very.
A new Italian roadster.
It is, yeah. The Piat. The P-O. The P-O. So today we want to talk about, there was a recent study from the OIG. OIG puts these studies out. This was just last month in October. And for those of you that don't know, the OIG puts out a lot of different studies and reports through typically Office of Audit Services and Office of Evaluation and Inspection. Some of these studies come out as a result of the work plan, the OIG work plan, which is a living, breathing document. And some of them are just ad hoc studies. And the one that came out just recently, it's an October of 25 study. It's study is OAS 2409005, and it's entitled Medicare Improperly Paid Suppliers $22.7 million over 7 years for Durable Medical Equipment, Prosthetics, or Orthotics, and Supplies Provided to Enrollees During Inpatient Stays. What does that mean? It means that during the study period, there's two studies. There was an initial study of 2015 to 2017 and a follow-up study that went from 2018 to 2024, where they basically did a re-review because they found a large dollar amount in the initial study on essentially payments that were improperly paid to patients that were inpatient, hospitals, SNP, things of that sort. Now, what's interesting is that these studies are not uncommon, meaning follow-up studies, meaning that OAS, Office of Audit Services, or OENI, Office of Evaluation and Inspection, will do these empirical analyses. And when they do these empirical analyses, they will come up with findings. And depending upon what those findings are and recommendations and the implementation of recommendations will potentially result in OIG doing a follow-up study on the exact same topic, but for a more contemporaneous time period, because they want to test, did CMS do anything to fix this problem, or did providers change their behavior? And in this study, what they found was that from the DME perspective, patients were getting DME that was being billed through Medicare Part B as in boy, which is covered as a DME benefit. But people were in inpatient instances where they were entitled to get that DME as part of that DRG for that inpatient. And so essentially what you've got is a version of double billing, because the DRG contemplates certain items, services, and procedures that aren't considered outliers or a la carte, so to speak, and are otherwise contemplated within what the framework of that DRG is. And then these are things that would be billed separately. And Wade, I want to start with you because, when we talked about this study, the thing that kind of stood out was this isn't just relegated to DME. We see this with other sectors where there's inpatient, and the fact that some basic data matching should stop these claims. But obviously the first thing is when people are in an inpatient status, those are not live claims, right? People go to the hospital, they're in a SNF. Let's take the hospital first. They get out of the hospital and the claim isn't submitted maybe for weeks afterwards. And so it is possible that there is that double billing that can happen. But in a SNF scenario where patients have kind of a definitive length of stay or maybe in for a longer period of time, it may be a little different. But what we do know is that this isn't just an endemic issue with DME. We see this with other sectors. And one would think that some data matching might be a way to help this, but there is a challenge. And the challenge is that claims are not processed live. And so we don't see necessarily a hospital claim going the same time as there is, maybe a Part B claim or something like that. But certainly what we can certainly see is that the challenge is that some edits may or may not be in place to prevent these claims from happening.
Right. And that it, I think it happens a lot with prescription drugs to medications. You can have a double billing situation there. But you're right. The data match failures, that there's edits that should be in place that that should catch this. And there's code that's written that should be able to catch these. I mean, I think a lot of times there is an edit in place, but it's maybe not efficient, where there's still things that are getting by it. So it has to, and that can be a result of a study like this, where they see that there is an audit in place, and they had mentioned that there was one before, but it wasn't catching this. So it's an audit, but it's not a sufficient audit. So it has to be rewritten. The code has to be rewritten to be more effective, basically. And another thing that occurred to me, that it's kind of like a secondary thought, but it's like the fact that this was supposed to be covered under the DRG code, but the DME company billed it as well. And it talked about how that there can be arrangements between the facility and the DME provider to have the facility pay the DME provider. I mean, there's certain amounts of DME that would have to be prescribed and provided to the member or the beneficiary, depending on what the DRG code is. But it's, that should be part of a process where the arrangement that they have set up, if the DME company provides it, they get paid through the institution, they get paid through Part A. So it was curious to me that how is this happening? Is it just because the DME company is not aware of that payment agreement, the whole prospective payment system? Or is there, you know, with OI type cases, and I don't, this isn't an OI criminal investigation, it's a study, so they're not going to look into this, but I was curious as to, like, how did this happen? Who initiated the Part B claim being submitted and the member or the beneficiary having to pay the deductible that they should not have had to pay if it went through Part A? So it didn't really go into that, and I wouldn't suspect it would for this type of like a study, but I'm just curious the mechanics of, like, where did that decision to bill it twice essentially, or was it just a mistake of fact that the DME company didn't realize that the institution is getting paid through a Part A DRG payment? Well, it didn't go into that.
Well, when you bring up an interesting point, which is that at least my read of this is that the DME supplier providing whatever that DME is third party and is not internal to the facility, whatever right. that facility is. Because it just talked about IP, inpatient. It didn't say if it was a hospital, a SNF, or a hospice, right? So in the hospital setting, most of the time, the DME is provided right through the hospital. They provide that DME, and that's just kind of the way it is. But we know that in the SNF and the hospice setting, that's typically not the case, right? A SNF isn't, you know, they may be purchasing a bunch of DME, but they're purchasing it through third-party wholesalers. And then, you know, they're in turn, they are getting paid indirectly, right, through that DRG. And so the suppliers in the real world, what should be happening is the DME supplier, the third-party supplier, should be invoicing the SNF or the hospice directly. And so that's a great point, Wade, which is that the DME supplier, you know, if we take away this premise of live data matching, because this is likely not the hospital setting. When we talk about inpatient, it could be, but, you know, when we're talking about live claims, certainly if there's a third party providing that DME, they should know the rules to know, hey, this should be a direct invoice. And actually, they should have a contract
right.
with the SNF, the hospice, whatever it is, the hospital, that says, you know, before we submit a claim, we will confirm that this is meeting the requirements under the coverage under that DRG, because this is really just a version of double billing. Now, the argument, right, is going to be made that the third-party supplier doesn't have purview into what the hospital, the SNF, or whatever is billing, but that's kind of where part of that responsibility lies. You know, we see this all the time where a third party should be billing directly to the entity in this case, the SNF, the hospital, the hospice, and get reimbursed through some sort of invoicing arrangement and fee schedule that's set up. And whether that fee schedule is a mirroring, meaning, look, if I provide a bed, if I provide 100 diapers to the nursing home and the reimbursement for 100 diapers is $100, then one would suspect that the contract between the DME supplier and the receiving entity is a fee schedule matching, right? Where whatever they would get paid is what they have to pass on or something similar to that. You know, obviously in the hospice and in the nursing home and in the hospital setting, those items, services are all contemplated under the DRG. So there has to be a discussion between the parties. So that data match may not be there, but certainly the point that you're making, which is I agree with, is it's incumbent upon the billing entity, which in this case is the DME supplier, to figure their stuff out. Right. And so, Matt, it kind of gets to the other half of this, which is that at the end of these studies, and people should really read, if you're not going to read the granular level of the study, the pieces to read of the study are the methodology and then the punchline, right? This is like, there's a one pager, there's the full report, the one or two pagers, cliff notes, the full report goes into the gross detail of the analysis. And really what people need to do is kind of take a little bit of a hybrid approach. Look at the two pager and then skim the report, because at the end of the day, what you want is you want the punchline. And the punchline is, how did they come up with this overpayment? And what were the recommendations? And then most importantly is, what recommendations were implemented or unimplemented, argued, disagreed with? Now, we know that every year HHS OIG puts out its list of typically the top 10 unimplemented recommendations. And you look at those unimplemented recommendations, and they sometimes can result in projected savings of tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. But the thing here was that the one recommendation that CMS opined about was they did not feel that they needed to go and review the edits that were in place. Now, part of the reason for why they might not think that they need to look at the edits is because if most of the study relied upon inpatient, as in hospital, doing a review of the edits may not be a useful exercise, because it's an after the fact, it's a pay and chase anyway. But it certainly does lend itself to that broader discussion that we were just having with Wade about, you know, maybe it's a SNF or it's something where there's a third party. But certainly this is one of those examples where, from a plan perspective, do a little bit of penetration testing on your own data and see, do you have an edit in place? Is this valuable? And kind of why these studies are important to the non-Medicare Part A, Part B community.
Yeah. These studies, you know, we've all been with the IG late 80s, you guys in the 90s. These studies have been going on since that time and even before. I mean, since the IGs have been invented, these studies have gone on. I recall similar types of studies on duplicate payments. One of my first cases involved a hospice and some hospitals where both were being paid for the hospitalizations of patients, where it's supposed to be that the hospice gets paid for any hospitalization that it takes place due to the diagnosis of the patient being related to the terminal diagnosis. Then they in turn would pay the hospital for that stay. Well, in this instance, they never paid the hospital. They got their money, the hospital got their money, and they were both happy. You know, so and there was no contract between them or anything like that. It was just blind ignorance, perhaps, or something more. But what we found at that point, I worked with the Office of Audit at that point, they found that that was nationwide. These edits were not in place nationwide. So this type of thing goes on forever. And it took us 2 to 3 years to convince CMS to change, at that point, the common working file to make those edits in place, because of the two different billing systems that were being used, one by the hospice, one by the hospitals. The complications behind CMS changing these edits, they look at those things like, is it worth it? You know, $22 million or whatever this study found, how much is it going to cost them to change those edits, and is it worthwhile? That's a question they always ask. And is it really that widespread? Is it a problem? We fixed them once. This is the second study. We fixed it once. It dropped 90% or something like that. Now, you know, this is just around the edges. Is it worth our while to do it? As a taxpayer? Yes.
Yeah.
But as someone running a mammoth healthcare plan like CMS is doing, they take all of that into consideration. Whether they should or not, that's a question for other people. But these things go well beyond Medicare as well. They go beyond DME. They go beyond hospice. You talked about ambulances earlier. On the Medicaid side, in many states, an ambulance trip from a nursing home to wherever is covered by the nursing home. They get paid as part of their daily rate on those ambulance trips. We found when we were doing the UPIC, ambulance companies were billing for these trips, and the nursing home was getting, you know, money for, you know, as part of their daily rate for these trips. States had no idea. Those edits were not in place, so we implemented those changes. We found that in several of our states, and then shared that with the other UPICs, and they found them in their states as well. So it goes well beyond single instance, you know, and institutional stuff. It's everywhere, and whether it's PT in a nursing in a SNF, DME in a nursing home or a hospital, it's rampant. We've been working with our plans here at Advise on edit implementation, and we'll find that they either don't have them in place, they had them in the wrong place in the payment chain, so it's not catching it at the right time, so the payments are being made, or somehow through the way the providers are billing, it's getting around the edits, whether it's the use of modifiers, or if it's an NCCI that you're not supposed to bill two things at the same time, they submit them on separate claims on separate days, and it gets around those edits. So there's so many factors that go into implementation of these edits that you've really got to follow through, which the OIG is doing, to get these changes made.
Yeah, and this is a great example of where there's a nuance, and the nuance is that if the inpatient services are hospital-based, the issue is going to be that the edit is going to kick in on the after one claim is paid, right? Yeah. So the edit doesn't necessarily need to, the edit's kind of a delayed edit. It's not a live edit, right? So the hospital is getting paid, and then if there's a third party supplier that's submitting that claim after the fact, that's where that edit will kick in. Because, you know, obviously the question always is, how is it that, you know, this wasn't stopped beforehand? That's always the question, right? How is it that this fraud wasn't stopped beforehand? And this is one of those unique examples where it's you have to wait for that second claim to come in to be able to stop it. But, you know, obviously it still then begs the question of, if you had the edit in place when the DME supplier, because that's the implication here, is that there is a claim being submitted by a third party.
Yep.
Yeah. And if there's a claim being submitted by a third party, the question is, why isn't that claim being stopped? Because the first claim is what should have been paid. And I think part of the metric on this is that you have to be able to understand, are all DME supplies provided to someone in an inpatient setting covered under that DRG or not? And there may be a list of items that are not covered that are separately billable. That doesn't mean that you can't have an edit in place for it, because when you submit that bill, when that third party submits that bill for that piece of DME, you could cross-reference it back to the DRG because, right, if a person has a certain DRG, there's potentially a list of things, right? If someone had a hip replacement, for example, there's going to be things like a walker, a commode, you know, who knows what, right? Bandaging, whatever it may be, that are all things that would likely be contemplated that are going to be part of that DRG. Because what people, I think, always need to remember is that just because there's a DRG doesn't mean that there are things that aren't covered outside of that DRG. There's plenty of outliers in which the hospital can bill as line items, like a la carte, things that the DRG doesn't always contemplate, because the DRG doesn't contemplate 100% of the things. It contemplates most of the things. And I think that's where, you know, that's where I think on the on the plan side, you have to do these kind of penetration tests and interrogate your edits and make sure. And that's why we always say, like, doing a review of your edits can't just be NCCI and MUE, and you've got to do these more than once a year. And that's where SIU needs to work with payment integrity, needs to work with whatever department you've got on your IT control side to rectify these potential issues, because you're going to have these mismatches and things of that sort. Things are always going to slip through the cracks because of the way we work payment integrity in this country. But, you know, that's why these studies become important, right?
Yes. If you, going back to an old saying, I'd rather have 10 guilty men go free than to jail one innocent man. It's the same thing with these edits. When they're being put in place, they're looking to make sure that they don't inappropriately capture or deny a legitimate claim. So they make these edits as limited as possible to make sure that they're, you know, they're not allowing, they allow the exceptions to go through, like you were talking about with the different line items and things like that. So they limit these edits as much as they can to just catch the ones that are for sure, without a doubt, should be denied, and not right. Catch in the net any tuna with, or any dolphins with the tuna.
Well, and this also becomes one of the examples that you can use if you're looking to do some payment integrity work in the absence of medical records, right? When you look at these OE&I studies, a lot of times these OE&I studies fall under what we would call strict liability, right? The policy says this, you billed for that, there's not a record that's found. And I know I've talked about this on other podcasts. A couple of years ago, we worked on a project involving a pain management doctor who was billing for an excessive number of facet joint injections. And the policies generally said you can only do 5 on a patient in a rolling 12-month period. And if you exceed 5 on a patient in a rolling 12-month period, it's considered medically unnecessary. That study was a strict liability study. The provider that we worked with had really well-documented medical records that supported the medical necessity, but the policy said no more than 5. Anything more than 5, we don't pay you. It doesn't matter if there's medical necessity or not. That's it, right? So when you look at these kinds of things under these like strict liability type cases, you can certainly do some from a payment integrity perspective, because we always get asked, right? How could we do these reviews in the absence of medical records? Because the medical records piece of it creates inefficiencies. Time inefficiency, opportunity cost, ROI, to say the least on those three. And so, you know, if there's opportunities to be able to identify methodologies within the data to do a data match and then identify an overpayment on strict liability cases, this is an example of how you would do that. So we are curious. So if any of you on the SIU side are doing any of these types of projects where you're doing strict liability related investigations that are very heavily centric on data and very light, if any, on medical records, and you're having some successes, we would love to hear about that, because we're starting to do some of that here and identifying some of these instances where we're finding these mismatches of data. We're not talking about recoding E&Ms and things that are subject to subjectivity and discussion and audit and appeals and all that. We're talking about like an example like, you know, these examples like we just gave. So I'm just going to see what people are thinking about on that. So these studies are great. And, you know, I don't recommend that you read the entirety of the study unless you are a geek in the statistics world or sampling, because they go very, very heavily into the methodology. So if you're someone that's interested in learning more about how methodology works and how it's set up and statistical sampling and strata and convenience studies and all of that, this is a way to figure it out. But if you're just looking for the quick and dirty, the two pager will tell you what you need to know. And it's a good way to just kind of get right to the heart of the matter. So let us know your thoughts. Good seeing you guys as always. Matt didn't get the memo. He's apparently he's on vacation.
It's okay. Always on vacation. Working for Advise is like being on vacation.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure. I don't know what Advise company you work for, but okay.
Just that the site is the seventh circle of hell, but that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, always good to see you guys. Everybody that tunes in every week, I, it's crazy how I talk to people through LinkedIn or meetings or whatever. And more I just hear about more and more people that are tuning into the podcast each week. So it's really, it's great. And we love sharing that information. And we love the fact that people are giving us the feedback on the value that they're getting. So we appreciate that. We appreciate everybody tuning in every week and grabbing this off of our newsletter or our YouTube channel or Spotify or any of that. So, you know, for us, it's a great way to share some information. And for some of you, it's a way to get away from listening to the day-to-day droning on that goes on in the world, because news is pretty humdrum these days. So it's good to step away and step into some different types of shenanigans. So we appreciate that. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.